What the? No! Why now? Mom, the power went out.
Everyone knows that feeling of agonizing frustration when they're in the middle of something really important and bam, the power goes out.
Ugh, I hate that.
But have you ever wondered who's behind the scenes to make sure the electricity comes back on?
And the world.
My name is Cleo.
I'm Elisa.
And we're students at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
We took a class that focused on the growing global demand for energy.
Our professors and mentors took us to Northern California on a whirlwind tour of the state's electricity generation.
They coordinated with Pacific Gas and Electric,
or PG&E for short,
a main supplier of energy for the area. Over the course of a week, we toured PG&E's solar, hydro, and nuclear power plants. We learned a lot about how various energy sources work.
But something else really surprised us. Just how interesting it was to talk to the people operating the plants.
Our plane flew into San Francisco early Friday afternoon. The next day, we woke up at 5 a.m. and drove high up in the Sierra Nevadas to Spalding Lake, which serves as a reservoir for a hydroelectric facility.
Those of us who fell asleep on the way woke up to a dramatic change in scenery.
Suddenly, we were surrounded by pine-covered mountains.
It was so beautiful. One minute we'd be surrounded by trees, and the next a valley would open up in front of us, enclosed by huge mountaintops.
It was apparent that our love for the scenery was shared by the employees we met there.
Phil Lee is an engineer who works in the drum powerhouses, where water from Spalding Lake ends up.
After speeding down the mountainside in huge tubes, the water runs through large wheels and turbines that spin PG&E's generators.
Phil had some really interesting things to say about how he started working in power generation.
I kind of fell into power generation. I had the choice when I graduated to go into manufacturing cars or going into power gen, so I worked at a steam plant. But I would say that out of all power generation, hydro is one of the most beautiful ones to work in. You know, driving up, this is what you do on your weekends when you hike, right? You go to these reservoirs and you look at them.
Phil is one of a handful of workers who are on site at any given time. Because there are so few people and they spend so much time with each other, it was clear they were all really good friends. After all, they've gone through many stressful experiences together.
Which we got to hear about. Even without understanding all the mechanical details, it's easy to imagine what the situation must have been like.
We get into some crazy scenarios. You know, I'll give an example of one. You know, we over-traveled the TSV on Spalding Unit 2. You know, we had to pop it back the other direction. So what did they teach you in engineering school on how to do that, Phil?
Don't get yourself in that situation to begin with.
So we find ourselves in those situations quite often, right? And this wasn't, you know, it wasn't really our fault. We're sitting there scratching our heads, like, how are we gonna do this? Like, literally, we had sledgehammers, like, beating on this thing. Like, that's not gonna work. And I'm just like, yeah, just go do it, man. It'll be fine. Like, no, dude, we can't just go push on this.
I was sweating bullets.
Yeah, so.
Watching them joke around with each other gave us a good sense of how close the plant workers were.
It was really fun.
We ended up staying for a while after the tour just listening to them tell stories. But eventually we had to leave.
From high up in the mountains, we traveled more than 400 miles south along the California coast to the charming city of San Luis Obispo. The Diablo Canyon nuclear plant sits close by.
But much like the Drum hydro plant, Diablo Canyon seems far removed from any civilization.
Perched 85 feet above sea level, overlooking the Pacific Ocean, Diablo is tucked between two hills in California's southern coastal range.
The majority of the view was taken up by two tall concrete domes and a huge, imposing brown building with narrow slit windows.
We were led outside by Brian Cunningham, the plant's supervisor of nuclear environmental services, to see where the water comes from that's used for cooling within the plant.
Out here, you'll know some seals and stuff hanging out. We often have otters rafting in here. So our intake coves created somewhat of a marine sanctuary. And then our breakwaters have actually created habitat as well. We have a robust marine monitoring program. I'll talk about that a little more. We manage debris and do a lot of oceanographic surveys. And that's a lot of fun.
I would love to work in a place where I could glance outside and see otters. But the plant does have some effects on the environment.
That's true. Brian told us that the warm water flowing out from the plant is affecting the environment around Diablo.
There have been impacts, the most dramatic being that you can look at the rocky area along here versus rocky areas you'll see elsewhere on the coast, and they're relatively barren. There's loss of alga there.
We were told that when the power plant stops operating, the plant and animal life will return to normal within 2 to 3 years. While the employees get to work in beautiful natural settings every day, the locations also create challenges.
In the case of Diablo, because it's located on the water's edge and surrounded by tectonic faults, people are worried about earthquakes.
Which is a legitimate concern, right? The Fukushima disaster happened because of an earthquake that led to a tsunami.
But really, it was just the tsunami that the Fukushima plant couldn't withstand. At the Diablo Education Center, John Lindsay, a media relations representative for PG&E, highlighted the difference between Fukushima and Diablo.
The earthquake hit, and it was 9.0 on the Richter scale. And the plant did fine. Problem was, the plant was built almost at sea level. 30 minutes later, they had a 45-foot tsunami that came in, and it flooded their diesel generators. Diablo Canyon, if you look over there, we're actually built 85 feet above sea level. The largest tsunami we'd probably ever see along our coastline, at the most, would be 30 feet.
However, people aren't just worried about earthquakes because of Fukushima. There are concerns that Diablo's seismic risks have not been well assessed.
Staff at the plant say they've added features and structures so the plant can better withstand a major earthquake.
But the issue certainly hasn't been resolved.
There's also public concern about nuclear waste. Nuclear waste remains dangerous for a very long time after it's generated, so it must be handled carefully.
Finding long-term solutions for storing the waste is a problem that hasn't been solved.
Another issue that California power generation is facing is the drought.
California has been in a drought for almost 4 years now. The lack of water is affecting agriculture and increasing the possibility of wildfires.
It's affecting the lives of many people, too. We talked to George Matsumoto, a scientist and educator at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, who told us how the drought is constantly affecting his daily life.
Everybody's trying to do their part. You know, I don't water my yard. I've got rain collection buckets underneath all my downspouts. And to my son's great shame, I even have 5-gallon buckets in the shower. So as he's waiting for the water to heat up, I ask him to save the water so we could use it to water the plants that we do have in the yard.
Hydroelectric plants use water to generate electricity by harnessing the energy of the water as it travels down from higher places. So the drought has been causing big problems for hydro as an energy source.
At PG&E's headquarters, the employees told us that demand for energy peaks twice on a typical day, once in the morning when people are getting ready for work, and once in the evening when they come home.
Careful management of different energy sources is needed to handle this double peak.
Consistent energy sources like fossil fuels or nuclear power can produce power whenever needed, but sources like solar and wind can only produce power when there's sun or wind.
When there isn't enough of those, something else needs to kick in.
Here's how it works. Your home and all the power companies are connected to the grid. When you wake up and start using energy, power companies increase their electricity production.
But when solar panels start producing a lot of electricity in the middle of a bright sunny day, power generated from hydro or fossil fuels can decrease.
Then, when the sun starts to go down, solar panels stop generating electricity, and another power source has to pick up the slack.
Otherwise, people's lights go out. Hydropower can make up for other energy sources during times of peak demand. A hydro plant has the ability to store water in reservoirs.
But Brandon Bonchio, one of the hydro operators, told us that because of the drought, hydro can currently supply only one of the two peaks per day.
We are just simply meeting demands. We don't even have enough water right now to supply double peaking. We only do in the afternoon peak because of our drought situation. Relying heavily on gases and nuclear.
And the drought is affecting more than just hydropower, as C.B. Hall, a manager at PG&E, explained.
So the drought is serious right now for us. But hydro, to be honest, is not the high priority when it comes to water. Water is, it's first about people, it's about agriculture. Power is like, you know, third tier priority.
Cleo and I thought it was really interesting to hear about how the natural setting,
the mountains, the geology, the recent drought,
are affecting power generation.
Some of our classmates had a different takeaway.
We'll let them tell you about it.
Thanks, Elisa. I'm Jake.
And I'm Mackenzie.
For us, one of the coolest parts of the trip was seeing what it was like to work at one of these power plants.
One of the workers, Willie Whittlesey, is the generation supervisor at Drum Switching Center, which manages the generation for the local hydro facility.
Hydro operations is interesting because it's real time and it's happening all the time. It doesn't stop. Even when we take our 2 week outages, that's only a 2 week outage on the Spalding Drummer 5 unit. All the other units are still running. We're still delivering water in other areas. So it makes it fun, something you never even thought about. Comes up every day and you're learning. Down by the
water with the steel turbines humming. Speaking with Whaley really opened our eyes to the fact that power generation is real time. Energy demand is constantly changing during the day.
At the Drum Switching Center, we spoke with John James. He's been a hydro operator for over 10 years. From the control room, he can remotely see every stream and power station that PG&E has in the area. He and his coworkers adjust the hydro generation on an hour-by-hour basis.
This schedule is based on two factors: predictions of demand and power generation by other types of energy, particularly renewables, since they're more variable.
But anything can happen. If a machine at another power plant happens to break, the power demand doesn't change. So that plant might call hydro and ask them to cover for them for an hour until they fix the machine.
John James said being an operator is a 24/7 job. There's got to be at least one person on shift at all times, and there's usually many people there on a weekday. Beeping alarms, accompanied by descriptions on his computer screen, would alert him if something was off.
We only talked to him for about 15 minutes, and it beeped quite a lot.
True, the ones we heard were just low-level alarms, but it made us realize that there must be a lot of people who are actively acknowledging these alarms and making sure that everything is running smoothly. But you know, for me, it was at Diablo when I realized just how intense power generation can get. Nuclear operators need to closely monitor the reactors by looking at temperatures, pressures, and more. And the most intense part? They have to make decisions in seconds.
For some operators at Diablo Canyon, out of every 5 weeks they work, they spend 1 week just training.
John Lindsay helped put this ratio in perspective.
Our operators spend 20% of their time in training. So if your physician spent 20% of his or her time in training, you probably couldn't afford to go see a doc. If your airline pilot spent 20% of their time in training, you probably couldn't afford to fly, right? In fact, our operators get over 400 hours of training per year. That's phenomenal.
Jeff Davis, one of the supervisors in charge of training the operators, explained why training is so tough.
We have no requirement for them to be perfect. We have a requirement for them to be excellent. And the only way we're going to get that is to just kick the livid snot out of them as often and frequently as we can in as many different ways as we can. We need them thinking. The more they're thinking, the more they're reacting by using thoughtful, considered actions to be successful, that is our goal for training.
It sounds exhausting.
But it's just part of the job. And the people working at the power plants, be it at Drum Powerhouse or Diablo Canyon, were just so passionate about working there.
Here's Ray Farmer, a roving operator at the Drum Spalding Hydro Facility.
I'd say my favorite part is showing people these places we have. A lot of people think EG&E owns Spalding Reservoir and it's just a recreation facility. A lot of people that come there don't even know that we're constantly monitoring the lake elevation, and they don't even realize that there's powerhouses connected to the downstream side of it. So it's really neat to show them how we're providing power and water for the whole county to use.
I think it's cool knowing that your job directly affects your community, but it wasn't just Ray. All of the workers we talked to were so excited about their own power plants.
C.B. Hull had a story about that.
When I first started working for PG&E, I got to visit Hydro, Solar, Diablo, and at every single one of those places, the people working there looked me right in the face and said, with totally sincerely, this is definitely the cleanest, cheapest form of energy.
Of course, they can't all be right.
At least we know that they really do believe in what they're doing.
To the workers, power generation isn't just their job, it's their life. Often, we hear about the challenges of the energy industry. The people we met are working on these challenges on a daily basis.
Hearing their stories made energy production feel more personal to me. I may not think of our experience with PG&E every time I turn on a light switch, but each time I think of hydropower, I'll remember Willie and Ray.
And when I think about nuclear power, I'll think of John Lindsay talking about how much time is spent in training. I could never imagine putting 20% of my working time into just training.
We learned a lot about energy on our trip, but what made it memorable was meeting all of the workers and learning about their stories.
It's really the people that make it all happen.
This program was produced in Terrascope Radio. It's a class developed by the MIT Terrascope Program in collaboration with the MIT Program in Comparative Media Studies. Terrascope is part of MIT's Office of Experiential Learning. Thanks to Samuel Boring, the director of Terrascope, and the administrator, Deborah Axel. We'd also like to thank Ari Epstein, the instructor of Terrascope Radio, the teaching fellows, Emma Chant and Anthony Occidentale, as well as the wonderful people at PG&E. Special thanks to Hal Gustin, our alumni mentor, and CB Hall of PG&E for organizing our amazing trip. This radio piece was produced by
Elisa Bowles,
Jake Berger,
Sarah Grunsfeld,
Jesse Shell,
Alexa Jaeger,
Jennifer Lowe,
Angela Leong,
Cleo McCrackis,
Mackenzie McDonald,
Agena Fidjiro-Warrior,
Robert Thorpe,
and Laurel Regibo Rocket. This story and others from Terrascope Radio can be found on the Public Radio Exchange, prx.org.